United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you, Ms. Tisa, and good morning to counsel. It's my pleasure this week to sit with Judge Britt Brandt and Judge Andrew Brasher. We wish we could be together with you in Miami, but we hope that day is not too far away. I think we have experienced counsel who is familiar with our stoplight timing system. I'm going to try and enforce it. And so with that, I think we're ready for the first case. United States of America versus Fabian Purple. I'm sure you'll correct my pronunciation because I suspect it might not be right.
You're muted.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Tim Cohn here on behalf of Fabian Purple. Even before the start of the trial in this case, it was clear that evidence of Purple's prior firearm convictions was entirely irrelevant as to both counts of the indictment and therefore inadmissible under Rule 404B, prove that Purple was guilty of being a felon in possession of a firearm. As to count one, the government would rely solely on the testimony of a shooting victim, Tavares Odom, that he was severely wounded by shots fired at him in close range by Purple. There was no question, as there can be in some cases, whether the firearm was a fake. The victim was in the hospital after the incident with gunshot wounds. There was no question whether the defendant knew how to handle a firearm. The victim testified that the defendant deliberately targeted him and shot him. And there could be no question that Purple knew that he was a convicted felon and that because of this status, he was prohibited from possessing a firearm. Purple so stipulated before trial. This stipulation also applied to count two. As to count two, the government would rely on ballistics evidence to show that the gun found in plain view in an automobile which Purple did not own or use, was the same gun used a few days earlier to fire the shots that wounded Tavares Odom. Once again, there could be no question that this gun was a fake or that the person who handled it didn't know how to handle a firearm. Further, the gun was found by police in plain view on the center console of the motor vehicle. So there could be no question, as there can be in some cases where a firearm is found hidden underneath a car seat or inside the glove compartment, that whoever was just seen driving that vehicle knew that he was in possession of a firearm. Further,
but did your client stipulate to knowledge or intent? I don't think that he did, right?
No, the defense was that, and before trial, the defense had filed a notice of alibi, and the defense was that the defendant was not the person who shot Tavares Odom, as charged at count one, or who was seen by police in a high-speed chase, as charged in count two. As to count one, at trial, several defense witnesses testified that on the date of the shooting, Purple was with them at a family gathering. As to count two, Purple himself took the stand and testified that he was not in the motor vehicle.
What do you say about this case? So United States versus Jernigan, where we said, quote, by pleading not guilty, a defendant places his knowledge at issue, end quote. And then we said, quote, there's a logical connection between a convicted felon's knowing possession at one time and his knowing possession of a firearm at another time, end quote. And we allowed this kind of previous conviction to come in that case?
Judge Brasher, Jernigan is the type of case I was alluding to a moment ago, actually the specific case where the firearm is found hidden underneath, I think the underneath a seat in that case. So that's the kind of case where the prior firearm conviction can be introduced to show prior knowledge and current knowledge that the person was in possession of a firearm. But this is not Jernigan. And
well, I understand that distinction, I guess. I understand that argument. But I guess my concern is that in Jernigan, we said by pleading not guilty, a defendant places his knowledge at issue. And it seems like the line that you're suggesting we draw is that sort of a coda to that, by pleading not guilty and not asserting an alibi defense or some other defense, a defendant places his knowledge at issue. I mean, what do you say about the idea that, look, once you pled not guilty, it was the government's obligation to prove the knowing possession of the firearm, no matter what your defense would have been?
Right, Judge. There's a, as you can imagine, I've given your question some thought already. The in the Gray case that's cited in our briefs, this court, it's an unpublished case, but it uses the very helpful phrase anticipated trial defense in connection with evaluating whether or not the 404B evidence should come in under the first prong of its analysis. And if one looks at this court's decisions again and again, it specifically in analyzing the 404B issue refers to the defendant's defense. In Ellisor, which is in the government's brief, this court says Ellisor's defense was, and it goes on to describe it and goes on to show to say why the prior conviction would be relevant. In Jernigan, the case you just mentioned, Judge, the court notes that in a prior case, Gomez, the prior conviction came in to rebut Gomez's claim. So again, it's rebutting a defense. In United States versus Garrett, a decision of just last year, the opinion says, and Garrett's main defense was, and it goes on to describe the defense and why the 404B evidence counters that defense. In Griffin, 2 years ago, the crux of Griffin's defense was that he did not, et cetera. And that again is used. So as a practical matter, Judge, what I would say is that while I read the same words you just did in the opinion, in reality, what this court does is to look at the anticipated trial defense and analyze how the prior conviction admissible in order to, as the Gomez opinion put it, rebut that defense.
And so then, I understand the distinction that you're raising, but the jury could believe or disbelieve the alibi defense. And if they disbelieve the alibi defense, the government still has to prove all of the elements of the crime, right?
Yes.
And so why wouldn't this evidence go towards the government's proof of all the elements of the crime? If assuming once they show that he was there, if the jury disbelieves the alibi offense, the government still has to show knowledge, right?
Right, Judge. But as I mentioned in my opening remarks, the knowledge element of 404B, as I'm sure Your Honor is aware, is extremely limited. It's limited to the recent Rehafe decision of the Supreme Court, which is to show that the defendant knew that he, for given his status, was prohibited from possessing.
Well, that's not entirely true, because this is with respect to count two, it's a constructive possession case. Just, there is, he wasn't found with the gun. And so there was an element that the government had to prove that it was the knowing possession of the gun. It wasn't an accidental possession where, you know, you, like you say, you drive your grandmother's car and she's got a shotgun in the back seat or something weird like that. So with count two, isn't there some element where the government would have had to prove that it wasn't sort of accidental possession, that he was just driving this car?
I don't think so, Judge, because again, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, the gun is found in plain view right there on the center console. So this is not a case where the defendant said, I didn't know there was a gun in the trunk of my grandmother's car. In addition, there's no evidence tying the defendant to that car, no DNA, no fingerprints. And in addition, he had filed an alibi defense indicating that the defense was not, I didn't know there was a gun in the car. His defense was, I was not in that car. And when that's the defense, it becomes a violation of Rule 404B to tell the jury, as unfortunately the prosecutor did in this case in closing argument, in trying to decide whether or not the defendant was accidentally at the scene of the crime, you can consider the prior convictions. That's wrong. That's incorrect. That is not why a prior conviction comes in. That's saying he did it before, so he must have been in that car. That is not a correct statement, and unfortunately, it means that this conviction was wrongly obtained, and this court should reverse it.
Let me ask you one final question, if I may, which is that the defendant testified in the case. Wouldn't have these convictions have come in, and didn't at least the convictions, couldn't they have come in cross-examination during his testimony?
Good question, Judge Brasher. The government, the analysis of that cross-examination would be an application of a different rule, which is Rule 609, as I'm sure Your Honor is aware. The government's brief does not cite Rule 609. So for this court to reach 609 would be to reach an argument that the government has frankly waived. But in addition, on the merits, the judge in this case would have informed the defendant before he took the stand. And to his credit, this trial judge did this. Listen, I have kept out your prior convictions so far during this trial because I have a sound understanding of Rule 404B. But I got to tell you take the stand, I may let this conviction in, that conviction in, all of your conviction in, none of them in. We don't know how the trial judge would have ruled, and we also don't know how the defendant would have reacted in, say, the worst case scenario where he's told all your convictions are now coming in. Perhaps the defendant does not take the stand and relies on his trial lawyer's cross-examination of the police officers to show that he was actually never in that car. After all, this was a high-speed chase at night. Perhaps the officers didn't really identify the driver correctly. There's room for reasonable doubt, let's put it that way.
Thank you. Well, you've saved some time for rebuttal, so we'll hear from you again. Mr. Dion.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Scott Dion on behalf of the United States. This is a case about a district judge relying on this court's guidance, both published and non-published, in making the type of 404B decision that arises regularly in felon in possession cases, and particularly where constructive possession is an issue. So the operative question here is whether the district court made a clear error of judgment in allowing the prior convictions in, when this court's cases indicated yes, and when, in light of the facts known to the district court at the time of admission, the prior convictions otherwise fell within the bounds of 404B. Mr. Perpow, heading into trial, denied the elements of the offense. He pled not guilty, and he only stipulated to the knowledge of status element. And so I don't believe it's a controversial point to say that heading into trial, it's the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt all of the elements that Mr. Perpall did not deny. Now, Mr. Perpall seems to flip positions here because during his opening statement, he made that the central issue of his case. Although he did, prior to trial, notice an alibi defense, during his opening statements, he called this a police evidence case. He said the police evidence is going to be inconclusive as to each of the counts. And as to count two, he said count two is based on inconclusive police evidence and the lack of physical evidence other than the presence of a gun in the car, which he noted was stolen. And so his defense, as far as the
government— Mr. Dion, this is Beverly Martin. Speaking of flipping positions, you know, we see this 404B issue come up over and over and over again in these prosecutions. And so, Adam, you were not there at trial, I guess, right?
No, I was not.
Yeah. So at trial, you know, the prosecutor says, we really need this 404B evidence because this is a highly circumstantial case. This, I'm quoting from the transcript, this is a case with essentially one eyewitness only, and only police officer testifying, you know, only one police officer testifying, on and on. And so you win your motion because, I mean, the government wins the 404B motion. They get to bring the stuff in. And then on appeal, you know, you argue even if the court shouldn't have let it in, it was harmless error because we had such a strong case. You know, in your briefs, this was a substantial, there's substantial evidence in this case of the defendant's guilt. I mean, do you worry about that, you know, calling in to question the credibility of the government? And because we see this over and over and over again. And you go on, you know, for pages listing how much evidence there was, so we really didn't need the 404B evidence to begin with. I mean, do you have any concerns about that?
Right, and I respectfully don't, Your Honor, and it's because the analyses are different, the calculuses are different. So with respect to harmless error, that's a backward-looking calculus, and you ask, does the record as a whole contain substantial evidence of the defendant's guilt?
Is it your position that the trial lawyer didn't know what the evidence was going to be?
Well, it's our position that the trial lawyer unexpectedly, you know, there was a notice of alibi defense before trial. During opening statements, all signs pointed to not an alibi defense, but a lack of evidence defense. And so
was it the AUSA knew who the witnesses were going to be because presumably, you know, the AUSA had subpoenaed them, right? I mean, to say the AUSA was surprised by the evidence strikes me as a tough argument to make.
By the alibi defense or by the government's evidence? Because
the government's
what I'm saying
evidence.
Is the government tries the case it has in front of it, and during opening statements, the alibi defense was not mentioned once, neither by the government nor the defendant. And the defendant, frankly, made the central issue of the case the government's evidence. And so, yes, the government at the time was worried about a lack of connection between the firearm because there was a lack of forensic evidence and Mr. Perpall. But as it turns out, Mr. Perpall, once he took the stand, was a pretty incredible witness. And the jury clearly.
Let me ask you a question about that sort of tangentially related to what Judge Martin was talking about. So I understood what the government was saying at the beginning of the case to be, this is not a case where we found this guy with a gun on him. This is a circumstantial evidence case, and distinguishing this from a case where, you know, the typical felon in possession case where you find the guy and he's got the gun on him. In a case, and I think that's the line that the government was drawing there to say that's why this would be relevant I guess my question is that really true? Because of what Mr. Purpell has argued, Mr. Cohen has argued, that this is not a situation where there was constructive possession at issue. This was a situation where the gun was visible in the car. And is that a line that we should draw?
Well, the government would maintain that constructive possession was at issue. I mean, first of all, like I said in opening statements, they were denying the fact that there was DNA evidence, fingerprint evidence on the gun. They mentioned that it was in a stolen car. So it's the government's burden to prove that Mr. Purpell intentionally and voluntarily exercised control over the gun. And with just circumstantial evidence, I mean, yes, it was in plain view, but with just circumstantial evidence, you're leaving open the defendant saying in closing, the government hasn't, you know, there's no DNA evidence, there's no fingerprint evidence. This was found in a stolen vehicle. The government hasn't proven that I exercised control, the defendant exercised control over this gun. So
would the line be different? And I guess this goes to this issue. I mean, would the line be different if this were not a constructive possession case? So if this were a case where, for example, just count one was at issue, where it was not constructive possession, it was either he shot the guy or he didn't, would you concede that in that kind of case, this evidence would not be relevant to anything?
It might, I would, respectfully, I wouldn't concede that, and I would say it might be relevant, but under the 403 analysis, it might not be very probative. And that's where we really get to the issue of whether this evidence should come in or not, because it's about prosecutorial need, it's about the overall similarity between the extrinsic act and the charged offense, and it's about the remoteness of the extrinsic convictions. And so even in your standard found in possession case, I'd say, based on Jernigan, that evidence would be relevant for a non-propensity issue.
Well, what would it be relevant for? I mean, absence of mistake that he had the gun in his pocket or something? I mean,
exactly. So the government, as the jury was instructed here, the government has to prove that it was intentional and voluntary and not because of mistake or accident. And so without, you know, putting on as much evidence as we can into regarding the defendant's state of mind, was he voluntarily holding the gun? Was he intentionally holding the gun? And was it by mistake or accident? The government leaves open those types of arguments in closing. And so I would say, again, it would be relevant to proving those elements, but it would not be, I mean, it might not be admissible in your standard found in possession case under Rule 403. And that's really the distinction that we're trying to make here. When a defendant goes to trial and denies the elements, he calls into question each element of the offense, and we maintain that Jernigan and Taylor and a number of other unpublished cases squarely call this type of evidence relevant to a non-propensity issue.
So, I mean, I think the line that, and so just correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm misunderstanding your argument, but it sounds like the line that you're suggesting that we draw is that when the defendant pleads not guilty in a constructive possession case, evidence of prior possession is relevant, and not only relevant, but admissible.
I would say generally that's true based on Jernigan and Taylor. And remember, Taylor is not a case where the defendant had accidentally had his grandmother's gun in the trunk of his car. Taylor was the case about a defendant fleeing from police, and the police witnessed him throwing a black object on the ground. And this court, again, said that it wasn't an abuse of discretion to allow a prior 404B, prior felon in possession conviction in under 404B to prove constructive possession there. And so the government, yes, would maintain that generally speaking, if a defendant pleads not guilty in a constructive possession case, the evidence is relevant and admissible. If the court has no further questions, the government, well, actually one more point about rules, Mr. Cohn's discussion about Rule 609 on cross-examination. Prior to Mr. Perpel testifying, there was a pretty long discussion about Rule 609, because on cross-examination, the government asked Mr. Perpel about all of his prior felonies. The issue prior to his testimony was whether, beyond Government Exhibits 17 and 18, whether the government could ask about his prior, I believe it was a prior attempted murder charge and some other related charges. And so there was a pretty extended discussion about Rule 609, and the court evaluated all of these prior convictions, including Government Exhibits 17 and 18, and said, look, beyond those, it's cumulative on cross. So I just wanted to point that out, because in case this reaches the point of harmless error, I believe these convictions would have come in under Rule 609 on cross-examination. If the court has no further questions, the government would rest on its briefs and ask that you affirm the convictions.
Thank you. Mr. Kahn?
Yes, Judge Martin. First, I think just as a, I should let the court know that the position that just because a defendant pleads not guilty, the evidence comes in, has been rejected in a number of circuits, squarely with the circuits pointing out that that would eviscerate, not my word, the opinion's words, that would eviscerate Rule 404B.
So, are you sure about that? I think those cases that you're citing are cases where the convictions come in to show that the defendant is a felon. They're not convictions that would come in to show intent or mistake or something like that. I mean, here the conviction is only relevant not to show that he's a felon, but to show intent or mistake. Are you sure that there are courts that have said that?
I am sure.
Okay, what courts? What courts have said that?
I think the Seventh Circuit has said that. I know the Seventh Circuit said that. The Fourth Circuit has said that, and I believe either the Eighth or the Tenth Circuit has said that. By the way, I should note, this is not, to my mind, a difficult matter. If you say every defendant who pleads not guilty.
Okay, I'm just looking at your brief. I don't see any.
I understand, Judge.
Citations to those circuits.
And I'm happy to file supplemental authority if that would be helpful to the court. I want to get back to the constructive possession question, because it seems to me that the reason that constructive possession opens the door a little bit to prior convictions coming in under Rule 404B is the constructive possession looks at whether the defendant had the intent to possess the firearm. And so this question of intent comes up because of constructive possession. And therefore, arguably under 404B, the prior conviction comes in to show intent. But it's not the fact that constructive possession involves circumstantial evidence that justifies 404B. To the contrary, the very reason that 404B exists is to prevent an improper inference by the jury. And circumstantial evidence is evidence that invites inferences. So I want to make that point clear. Taylor is the case that was mentioned by opposing counsel. In Taylor, the defendant was seen dropping an object. And so it was conceivable that his defense, I say conceivable because Taylor has one paragraph on the 404B issue, but conceivably what the court had in mind was that the defendant did not know that the object, the defense would be that he didn't know that the object he was dropping was a firearm. Here, though, as to count one, there's no question that it's a firearm. The gun's being fired and is severely wounding the person. As to count two,
It's the gun in plain view, the same gun in plain view in an automobile. So there's no question, did the defendant know whether it was a fake gun, a real gun, a gun that he could handle? So under both counts,
Do you think that most defendants in a constructive possession case would say that just because the gun is in plain view, they obviously knew that it was a real gun and intended to possess it? I think that would be an unusual argument for a defendant with a non-alibi defense to make.
Right. No, I agree, Judge. I think the constructive possession cases in this court are cases where the gun is not in plain view. And the question is, did the defendant know, in the 922G sense of the word, know that there was a gun in his or her possession? And so the prior conviction comes in to say, yes, chances are he would have known since he was previously convicted. But here, we don't have that situation. The gun's right there in the automobile. And the question is, do we believe the police or do we believe the defendant as to whether or not he was in that automobile? And it is incorrect and a serious error of law to allow a jury to draw an inference from a prior conviction to resolve who is telling the truth. It's simply holding the propensity of the defendant to commit the crime as a way of discrediting his testimony. Thank you, Your Honors. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Kuhn. We've got your case, and we appreciate the argument from both counsel. It's very helpful.